Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studios, my good friend Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. And, you know, Jason, this has just been such an unbelievable year that, you know, you've got Jeb Bush, who at the very outset was like he was the front runner going in, and now he's driving for Uber.
Right, he's driving for Uber. And then at the end of that segment, Rick, the best part to me was when he kind of made an exclamation with his arm and said, Jeb, exclamation point.
Yeah, except I didn't think that would come across on radio very well.
Yeah, but, no, that was a great bit.
Well, you know, what I appreciate about you is you understand political rhetoric. You understand what are kind of how key words, key phrases are. And maybe you can give us your idea of how you see this thing going. But before we get there, I want to ask you, what effect on a debate stage does it have for Jennifer Flowers to be sitting in the front row?
Well, we're in uncharted waters here.
That's what we have been for this entire campaign.
No, I saw that the Trump campaign has said that Jennifer Flowers will not be coming to the debate. That's what they've said. And so magnanimously,
Trump threatened to have her there, and she accepted.
That wasn't a threat. It was an invitation to a concerned citizen.
Well, that was after Mark Cuban had said he was going to be
in
the front row.
Yes, I know, yeah. And he's still planning to be there, I think, but maybe not in the front row.
Well, my understanding is actually the Commission on Debates kind of weighed in here and said, okay, enough of this nonsense.
The gamesmanship.
And trying to get in somebody's head.
Which there's frequently a lot of in these things. You know, on the day of debates, it's been said before that at that point maybe there's not a lot left to do. And so the two sides, the coaches for the two sides, start rifling through all the possibilities of what the other person might be plotting and kind of get themselves into a frenzy about it. It happened in 1992 when there was some concern. Actually, 1988 was one with George H.W. Bush where they were concerned that Michael Dukakis was going to challenge Bush to a one-on-one debate and get rid of the reporters.
Mm-hmm.
And so the response that the H.W. Bush people had was, well, that's fine. We'll just have our guy come out from behind the podium and ask Dukakis to do the same because, of course, he was on a riser.
Right.
Right? So they had their own little counter demonstration planned. Shenanigans.
Well, since we are truly in uncharted waters in this whole campaign, are we in uncharted waters on what we should expect out of this debate?
It's going to be different. I think it'll be different. I heard you talking about the Cubs earlier. I think Jack Brickhouse would have called it a Pier 6 Donnybrook going way back. You have, in a way, you have a matchup here between madness and method.
Yes.
You have somebody who's really unpredictable and somebody who is known for her lawyerly approach. The question to me is whether they're going to stick to those tactics. And I suspect that they will because they are who they are. And over 90 minutes, debates tend to reveal who people are. And I think the contrast will be fascinating. I think they both have some challenges ahead of them in dealing with each other and particularly in building trust with the American people. And I think that's where the debate will be won or lost.
Well, and that's I'm glad you brought that up because I've mentioned this in the past. And of course, you know, as we saw in the primaries with the exit polling among Democratic voters about the trust factor with Clinton, as we've seen in general election polling and the unfavorable ratings that these two candidates have. And I go back to when Hillary Clinton was here to keynote an Operation Push luncheon where she acknowledged that she had work to do to earn the trust of voters. But just saying that doesn't mean it's going to happen.
No, but trust is multifaceted. You know better than anybody that most campaigns ultimately turn on trust. Voters, all of us, don't know everything about all the issues. When we tune into a debate, our impressions of whether or not we actually trust somebody are going to be formed and are going to have some impact. When you go into the voting booth and you have a 50-50 call, who do I really trust to do the job? That's really what it comes down to. And it's not simply about being honest and trustworthy. That's a major component of it. But trust really is comprised of two different strands when it comes to elections. And one is authority. Do we think that somebody's up to the job? Do we trust them to answer the phone at 3 in the morning? And the other piece of it is the trust factor of, do I really like the person? And you can think about it.
Well,
like,
I think, that's the gut factor.
It's the gut factor. I mean, if you're going to buy a car from somebody, you don't have to like them, but it kind of helps if you do. If you're going to hire anybody, you don't have to love them every single day, but it sure helps if you like them a little bit. And this is something of a job interview. The president comes into our homes every day for the next 4 years or maybe 8 years, and that becomes important. And there are things in a debate that candidates can do to build those factors. Honest and trustworthy, not so much. But the other elements of trust, very much so.
The likability factor.
Likability and also the strength component. And for Trump, strangely, for somebody who has premised his campaign on strength, Clinton will do and has done a pretty decent job of distinguishing strength from brazenness,
mm-hmm.
two different things, and making strength about competence. And that's one of the battles that they'll be engaged in tomorrow night and through the next few weeks. But for Trump, in terms of the competence, if it becomes a test on competence, little things can go a long way. A little detail sprinkled in here and there.
Just
in an
a little bit.
Yeah. Organizing an answer, even having two points.
Coherency?
To even say, you know, there are two responses to that or 2 points to that, it sounds trivial, but in the mind of a listener or a viewer, it begins to sound coherent. It coheres. And then, of course, that's just
kind of like the mayor doing his 1-2-3 routine.
Yeah, well, that's the mayor's been involved in messaging for a long time.
But I mean that's kind of the point you're trying to make, though, is that if you can kind of you can show different levels of knowledge,
and that even in that way, maybe it demonstrates some reflection and something methodical about your approach. Do I think Trump's going to do a lot of that? Not really. But that opportunity is there.
We're speaking with Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio, joined by Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. We're talking about debate rhetoric and whether it can sway the voters. You know, it's so fascinating. It's 83% of those polled in the CBS poll are going to be watching this debate. But yet, it looks like maybe this narrow sliver of like 8% of the voters are undecided in that very same poll that are going to be watching this debate. Does a debate convince anybody to switch their vote?
Well, so you do have that sliver that can be convinced.
Right,
that you
convincible.
The convincible that you identified. But the other thing it might be able to do is to motivate those who are committed but not truly committed. And that's mm-hmm. a big issue for Clinton.
Correct.
Particularly where it relates to progressives, members of the Obama coalition, even people who were part of the Sanders coalition that she was having trouble reaching. As we talked a minute ago about the challenges Trump has, those are the challenges that she has. She communicates almost entirely logically. He communicates almost entirely emotionally. And so he needs to shore up some of the more logical aspects of his claims to get people to trust him more. She's just the opposite. She needs to be able to, as people say, connect better. And to me, what that really means is, to those that are part of the Obama group, she needs to inspire them more. And did that really one time, I think, really well in this campaign, and that was the night she won and gave a speech in New York. Those themes are the themes she needs to begin tying more of her answers to. Unity, progress, moving forward, inclusiveness, all the things that would contrast with Trump. Clinton is an exceptionally good tactical debater.
As we have seen,
she always knows her points. She's very crisp with them. She handles the thrust and parry of a debate very well. But what she does not do as well is take those individual answers and funnel them up to one unified set of themes. What does a vote for Hillary Clinton mean? Those themes, unity, progress, those are the themes she needs to stick to and hit, and they tend to be a little bit more inspirational. That's what she has to do to motivate those folks. The people who are middle-class voters, others that she struggled with, those without college degrees, for example, in the most recent ABC Washington Post poll, that's much more about identifying viscerally with their economic anxiety. They don't really trust her on that issue very well. And so the ability to connect with those people emotionally is very important for her. So she is just the opposite issue for Trump. And so her answers have to emphasize both the broader themes, but also those middle class concerns, and really be able to speak in a way that sounds like she understands where they're coming from. And that doesn't mean telling a story about somebody who's here or anything
the
like
anecdotal,
that.
Anecdotal.
Yeah, we don't need that.
But more of a, just more of a common parlance, I guess.
Conversational language, mm-hmm. what you would say in another context, non-lawyerly language. And even allusions to what it means to come home at the end of the day and have a stack of bills, you know, which is not something people associate with Hillary Clinton.
Right.
Right. But having that top of mind and being able to express it is really important for that connection. And so that
but that's
is
been
important
a,
for
but
her.
But that's been a problem. And you, yes, you emphasize what the debate could do.
Yep.
But when you look at her speeches, there's still that empathy factor that seems to be missing. And these are two speaking to supporters ostensibly.
Yeah.
So you've got, you know, you've got a home crowd, but I think there's, and this goes back when I covered her in 08, was that connect. It's a very difficult thing for her to do.
Well, let's talk about 08 for a minute. It's a great point because the moment at which she began to forge the best connections for her, the best emotional bonds with people, was in New Hampshire when she was really dissed by then-Senator Obama in the debate in New Hampshire when he said, "You're likable enough, Hillary." And it wasn't so much 2 days later when she cried, which she did, and that, to be sure, probably gained her a connection with people. It was actually the way she handled it in the debate. If you go back and look at it, she handled it with grace. She smiled and handled it almost in a so self-possessed way that it was inspiring the way that she dealt with that situation. And there was a lot that went into that. I mean, you're viewing it as somebody who really has just been put down on national television, but also as a female candidate for president and who handled it with equanimity. And that, to me, is very important when she's dealing with Trump. There really are kind of four levels of outrage that you could react to when it comes to Trump. And one is just to ignore him if he says something ridiculous. The second is to joke, and she's done that well throughout a series of debates and also in her speeches about him. The third is to shame him. And the fourth would be outrage. I would imagine that in practicing, there's sort of this gradation. I mean, if I were working with her, let's try all four of those.
Sure.
And I think she's a good enough performer on that stage to be able to calibrate what's necessary at any point in time. Humor is important. Firm with him, funny with us, about him. Basically separate us as an audience from him.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the tactic I would use. And then a healthy bit of shame, particularly when it comes to birtherism. That is something that I think is ripe for probing, because I think it'll drive him crazy.
And and also too, you know, where some of that lack of enthusiasm for her exists is with the African American community.
Yes,
and that's a perfect entree for her,
and for progressives, and for suburbanites who don't want to feel like they are on the side of going backwards in terms of the progress and social progress of this country.
All good points, and all good things to watch and see how and if they get established by the candidates. Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. As always, Jason, great to have you here in studio.
Rick,
thank you so much.
Thanks, Rick. Love being here.
We'll be back with more right after this.